Good. Well, welcome. I'm going to talk directly into this, I think. Welcome to what is the fourth in the series of our former foreign secretaries reflecting on their work and experience and their time in office. Just to bring to your attention, the final lecture will be delivered Tuesday of next week by Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who is going to be addressing the always interesting issue of the special relationship, if there is such one, between the United States and the United Kingdom, and that is next Tuesday evening. More eminently, though, I'm delighted to welcome Lord Hurd of Westwell in the county of Oxfordshire, who Lord Hurd, as I'm sure most of you know, has had nothing if not a varied as well as a distinguished career, first of all as a diplomat, serving variously in Beijing and in New York at the United Nations and in Rome, subsequently became the political secretary to Ted Heath at number 10 in 1970-1974, and later embarked on a very distinguished ministerial career, first of all as Northern Ireland secretary, then as Home Secretary, and then as Foreign Secretary between 1989 and 1995, working with both Margaret Thatcher and John Major, and tangling with such matters as the Maastricht Treaty, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the Gulf War, and of course the former Yugoslavia. Amongst the many other strings to his bow are his various callings in banking, chairing or taking part in various review bodies, reform of the House of Lords, for example, chairing the Prison Reform Trust. Amongst other things, he's president of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House. And as you may have noticed, and if you haven't already, I hope you will notice after the lecture, the author of an extremely readable and interesting set of memoirs, which Lord Hurd will be signing immediately after this session. I think without further ado, I will pass the baton on to Lord Hurd, who is going to talk about the situation after Iraq and what future there is for humanitarian intervention. Lord Hurd.
Well, I'd like to thank the LSE and Graham for having this idea of having this series, and for asking me to take part in it, and you ladies and gentlemen for coming, and Maurice Fraser for his kind words, and for taking the chair. Maurice has been part of my conscience for many years, and also a gadfly. He's managed to combine both those things, and he's been kind to do this today, and particularly kind, as all good chairman should, to mention the books which the subject has written. So thank you for that, Maurice. Any of you actually read my memoirs and get as far as the chapter when I become Foreign Secretary, we'll find, and it was very surprising to me at the time, that the first year of my time as Foreign Secretary was filled with the most amazing stream of good news from all parts of the world. I suppressed the temptation to describe this as cause and effect. I don't think it was entirely because I was Foreign Secretary that the news in the world turned so brilliant, but it certainly did. Within a few weeks of that time, the Berlin Wall came down and communist regimes began to collapse across the world, and the Cold War ended triumphantly for the West. The rhythm was broken, the rhythm of good cheer was broken when Saddam Hussein seized Kuwait, and that act led inexorably, I believe, to the Gulf War of 1991. All through this time, which was about a year, the things required, the processes of thought required of the British Foreign Secretary seemed to me, and still seem to me, pretty straightforward. I had a prolonged tussle sort of half in public and half behind the scenes with my Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher about German unification, and she drew back from outright opposition just in time to save us as a country from falling over a cliff. But neither in that nor in the Gulf War did there seem to be any huge moral or intellectual difficulty. In the Gulf War, in the War Cabinet, we had to take difficult and dangerous decisions. But here again, as I look back, the decision that Saddam Hussein's aggression had to be reversed seemed to us to require very little argument. And the sequence went on of diplomatic measures, economic measures, Security Council, bombing, invasion, because at each stage he refused himself to reverse the aggression. During all this time, the leadership which we received from the superpower, from the United States, from President Bush Sr., was, in my memory and in my diary, calm and reasonable and firm. But towards the end of 1991, the disintegration of Yugoslavia and the wars which followed in Croatia and then in Bosnia led us, I'm thinking really of British ministers, but other people as well, into a tangled thicket which seemed to have neither paths nor signposts. I don't want, it's not the subject of this lecture, to go into the details here. In my book, I try to set out plainly and without vainglory or excessive justification what we did, what we didn't do, why we did it, and why we refrained from doing it. Of course, there were those then who thought, without benefit of hindsight, that they did see clear signposts. There were people who believed that this was simply a matter of Serb aggression and nothing else, and not therefore, in essence, different from the aggression of Saddam Hussein against Kuwait, which we had just reversed. Others, and they were a majority in the cabinet, certainly, and in the House of Commons, saw these in Croatia and Bosnia essentially as civil wars where there was no clear British interest to justify us in taking risks. I must say, neither of those views actually made much sense, or made total sense, to the three British ministers who had to handle British policy day by day, namely the Prime Minister John Major, Malcolm Rifkind, who's talking to next week or at the end of this series, who was Defence Secretary at the time, and myself. Both at the time, and all of us looking back, and we've all written about it, we were dissatisfied with the way in which we and others sailed these uncharted waters. We didn't, at the time, philosophize, because philosophizing comes later. It was not that sort of crisis. But what we were, in fact, doing, I now see, is exploring. We were exploring, unhappily, the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, which is my theme tonight. To what extent, this was the question, to what extent was it the right, was it the duty of the international community in general, and Britain in particular, to send troops to kill and be killed in a country where Britain had no substantial commercial or strategic interest, but where Bosnian Serbs, to a lesser extent Bosnian Croats, and to an even lesser extent occasionally Bosnian Muslims, were savagely wrecking each other's lives? In answering that question, the British and the French sometimes had a different answer, week by week, from the United States. And this created a certain turbulence within the alliance, which we managed, though sometimes with difficulty, to keep within limits. What I'd like to do this evening, but I would like, with your permission, Maurice, to answer questions on anything that you think I ought to answer. And one of the advantages of being mostly retired is that if you don't know the answer, you can say so, and your career does not come to an end. So let's take full advantage of question time in a short time. But what I would like to do is to examine, since those days, since that background that I've described, the evolution of this doctrine of humanitarian intervention and the troubled relationships which it can cause among allies and within the UN. And I will have particular reference, spend a good deal of time in a minute or two, on the demonstration of that in Iraq as we speak. Of course, this concept of intervention on humanitarian grounds is familiar to all of you, and it's been around a long time. It underlay, for example, the efforts led by the Royal Navy to stamp out the slave trade in the 19th century. I mean, after we'd made a lot of money out of the slave trade, opinion turns against it, Parliament turned against it, and we spent a lot of effort in the 19th century stamping it out in other parts of the world. If you read the philosopher John Stuart Mill, you find that he puzzled over this question of humanitarian intervention when he was considering the way in which the Habsburg Empire repressed revolts in Hungary and in Italy in the middle of the 19th century. During the early part of my time as Foreign Secretary, during that happy first year, as it were, the striking example of humanitarian intervention was actually what we did to send troops with others into the north of Iraq to help the Kurds. And that was an initiative, I vividly remember, a personal initiative of the British Prime Minister, John Major, and it worked reasonably well. It was reasonably straightforward. By contrast, our intervention in Bosnia was gradual and tentative. It began with economic aid, it went on to the dispatch of troops to protect that aid, it went on to strenuous efforts by our military commanders, Mike Rose, to achieve pacification through local ceasefires and safe areas. And while these efforts were going on the ground, there were the diplomatic efforts, David Owen, whom we've already heard from, Peter Carrington, Cyrus Vines, others. As the war dragged on miserably, the Allied powers were galvanized into increasing their military strength on the ground, that was the British and the French, and into greater use of NATO bombing, that was the Americans. But throughout, and this is a point I want to emphasize, the use of force was not aimed at imposing a particular solution through bombs and missiles, through killing people, let alone regime change in any of the capitals concerned, Zagreb or, above all, Belgrade. Throughout, the aim was to curb atrocities and bring about a negotiated settlement. Now, after Bosnia, and what was actually on a larger scale, but of course less noticed, because things in Africa are less noticed, the failure to intervene from outside to check the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, the whole question of humanitarian intervention and the whole argument in favor of it was placed much higher on the international agenda. People felt we didn't do enough in Bosnia, we didn't do anything effective in Rwanda, we've got to be prepared to do more. The whole thing went up the scale in terms of popular attention and acceptance. And there were rapid interventions in Kosovo, in East Timor, and Sierra Leone. Now, all these three were different, the circumstances, the law was different, but the humanitarian motive, I would argue, in each of them was dominant. And because international law follows events rather than dictates them, and Professor Greenwood would agree with that, but I think that's probably true, it seemed that as if international law was evolving quite fast. Of course, there was no international treaty which established that it was legitimate for states to intervene for humanitarian purposes in other people's internal affairs. Indeed, so far as there was a text, it ran the other way. Article 2.7 of the UN Charter forbids the UN to intervene, quotes, in matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state, unquotes. I was as I think you mentioned, Maurice, I was a young diplomat in New York at the UN in the mid-50s, and that text was sacred. Because at that time, the UN was quite largely composed of people who just joined. They just joined because they'd just become independent. They'd just become independent because they'd shaken off or been relieved from colonial rule. The last thing they wanted was any suggestion that other people from outside, in particular anybody to do with their own colonial masters, was going to poke about in their affairs and say, you're not running your country well, you don't deserve your independence, let's take it away. And so Article 2.7, forbidding intervention in internal affairs, was a sacred text. But life went on, and the events I've described happened, and the mood changed, not totally, but it changed. And in 1998, the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, gave a notable lecture on this subject at Ditchley. And he said, state frontiers should no longer be seen as a watertight protection for war criminals or mass murderers. The fact that a conflict is internal does not give the parties any right to disregard the most basic rules of human conduct. And looking ahead to the unfolding disaster in Kosovo, he spoke just on the edge of the war, but before it, he indicated, the Secretary General of the UN, that if peaceful means failed, force might be needed. And a few months later, when the war in Kosovo was either going on or just finished, our own Prime Minister, Tony Blair, made a speech in Chicago which developed the same theme. Tony Blair said, "We were witnessing," this is the way the Prime Minister thinks and speaks, he's always on the edge of a great sort of new age of something. And on that occasion, we were seeing the beginnings of a new doctrine of international community. The principle of non-interference, Article 2.7, should be qualified, Tony Blair said, in important respects. Acts of genocide could never be a purely internal matter. Oppression, which produced massive flows of refugees, could properly be described as a threat to international peace and security, which, of course, means that if threat to international peace and security is something which people are entitled to deal with by force, and therefore that is a way into humanitarian intervention. And Tony Blair quoted with approval one of President Kennedy's more eloquent, but I must say, in my view, less meaningful phrases: freedom is indivisible, and when one man is enslaved, who is free? I mean, I think that's a rhetorical question, actually in practice, without meaning, but it illustrates the kind of mood which was current at that time. And there's no mystery, ladies and gentlemen, as to why that mood, change of mood occurred, why the Secretary General and the Prime Minister, two quite different people, following different intellectual routes, both came to very similar conclusions in 1998. Public opinion, in the Western democracies anyway, was no longer prepared to accept that their governments were powerless to prevent man-made atrocities on a large scale when, and this is a big qualification, when these atrocities were brought to their attention regularly by the mass media. Two questions, which have since become very relevant, were not seriously tested, it seems to me, in that debate. To what extent did countries outside the family of Western democracies share this view? And what level of cost in terms of lives and money, their own, but particularly other people's, were the Western democracies ready to incur in the effort for peace with justice, which at this time they talked about? But that was the change of mood. It was very clear. It stemmed from all things that were happening in the world. It stemmed from mass television. It stemmed from what was seen as failure in Bosnia and total failure in Rwanda. And I did a TV program at the time for BBC Two, and I wrote a book, and in that book I wrote, "We are all interventionists now." That was 1997. I'm not so sure in 2003. Events since September 11, 2001 have to some extent reopened the discussion, and I'd really be extremely interested to know in a minute or two, you know, to what extent you what line you feel is right in this discussion. But the discussion is reopened because the tragedy of September 11th moved the international debate away from this question of humanitarian intervention back to the much more traditional emphasis on self-defense. You attack me, I'm going to defend myself and obliterate you, or even if I think I'm pretty sure you're going to attack me, I'm going to obliterate you. But these are all arguments based on self-defense, and self-defense has always been accepted. It's specific in Article 51 of the Charter as a proper ground for military action. What immediately followed, or quickly followed, was the campaign in Afghanistan. That was justified and generally accepted, I would think, by world opinion, as an exercise of self-defense, given that there was no doubt that those who perpetrated the attacks on the United States on September 11th had their hiding place in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and were protected by the Taliban, the Afghan government. And a discussion about failed states started again. People have been talking about failed states for a long time, and Somalia was always quoted as the example, but the nature of the discussion changed after September 11th. It wasn't a question of the poor Somalis who had no effective institutions who must be helped to produce them. It was a question of the not-so-poor Somalis who, unless they were dealt with, might provide a dangerous opportunity for terrorists to attack, to establish a base to attack, from which to attack the West. The whole nature of discussion moved back, I would say, to a much more traditional defense, self-defense set of arguments. And this was, of course, also the primary argument for the Anglo-American preemptive strike on Iraq. The argument took various forms in the United States, though not actually in Britain. A short-lived attempt was made to identify Saddam Hussein directly with al-Qaeda, and thus with the assaults, atrocities on September 11th. The absence of any hard evidence for this suggestion caused it to evaporate. There followed, or accompanied that, stronger, was an argument based not on September 11th directly, but on Saddam Hussein's record as an aggressor, which was undoubted, and his possession, also undoubted, in earlier years of weapons of mass destruction. And we can all remember that both in the United States and Britain, this was, for weeks, months, the primary argument made. It's virtually evaporated now, in my view, as a result of the failure to discover the weapons, which it was argued were such a threat to Iraq's neighbors and to all of us. Then would produce weaker supplementary arguments, but still in this family of arguments about self-defense. For example, that the threat came not from actual weapons, but from plans, once again, to possess such weapons. Or else it is maintained strongly by Jack Straw, for example, that Saddam's defiance of Security Council resolutions stretching right back to the ceasefire resolutions of 1991 justified an attack on him. The difficulty I find about these extension supplements of the basic self-defense argument is that they don't in any way justify an immediate preemptive attack based on the American military timetable. Even if there's truth in them, and there obviously is truth in them, they point towards the kind of solution which the Secretary General at the time, which the majority of the Security Council at the time preferred, namely sustained peaceful pressure on the regime and the renewal of Mr. Blix, the renewal of UN inspections, rather than the dispatch of an army to kill and be killed. In his recent lecture to Justice, which I recommend, Lord Alexander Whedon, who's one of our leading lawyers, has, in my view, neatly demolished the arguments apparently put forward by the Attorney General, though we are not actually allowed to see the arguments put to the Cabinet by the Attorney General. Something has come out about what they were in a parliamentary answer, and I believe that Bob Alexander has neatly demolished the Attorney General's arguments upholding the legality of the Anglo-American preemptive strike. But because all these arguments, these post-September 11th arguments for attacking Iraq based on self-defense with the different ramifications I've very briefly and cursorily described, because those were evaporating, that led to a very sharp switch back to the humanitarian argument that I began with. The argument changed, and now it's changed almost entirely. The Prime Minister has always, temperamentally, intellectually, found himself most at home with that humanitarian argument, namely that whatever the truth about weapons, whatever the truth about Security Council resolutions, whatever the truth about plans for weapons, let's put all that on one side, forget that this was the main ground on which the British Parliament was persuaded to attack. Let's forget all that and just let's all agree that Saddam Hussein was an evil ruler and that Iraq and the world are better off without him. That was a brief summary of the Prime Minister's speech last night in the Mansion House. Put simply like that, of course, the argument cannot be denied. I don't think anyone really seriously questions the evil nature of Saddam Hussein's regime or the great harm he did to his own people and to their neighbors. But such simplicity, ladies and gentlemen, is not actually sufficient, because there are two questions which are not academic but critical for the future, which fall to be answered. The question of authority and the question of aftermath. Authority. Who is to decide that a ruler is so evil that on humanitarian grounds it is right to go to war to remove him? Regime change is a tidy, antiseptic phrase. But what is involved in addition to our own mounting casualties, I'm thinking particularly of the Americans, our own mounting casualties in Alliance, it's involved killing a much larger number, uncounted indeed, of innocent Iraqis and wrecking a country already badly damaged by sanctions and a ruthless dictatorship. This was entirely predictable. Who is to weigh the merits of this action? No, who is to weigh the costs, the suffering which we caused, against the merits of removing the dictator? Who is to judge? Where is the authority? It's a crucial question, isn't it? The answer is clear in the United Nations Charter, if you believe that that is, with all its fault, a sort of map for the world. According to the Charter, this judgment cannot be left to those who plan a war. It is reserved to the Security Council. Now, in the case of Kosovo, going back one, the government went to war on humanitarian grounds without achieving a judgment from the Security Council that this was justified. And the reasons for that was absolutely practical. They believed there would be a Russian veto, so they, as it were, they sidestepped, went round the Security Council, and came back to the Security Council when the war was over. This year, over Iraq, the situation is quite different. Before the Iraq war, the Prime Minister persuaded the President of the United States that we should try, as we had in the first Gulf War, but not in Kosovo, that we should try to obtain specific authorization from the Security Council for the use of force. We tried very hard, and we failed. And looking back, we can see now, I mean, in the heat of disappointment of that failure of Anglo-American diplomacy, a lot of blame, all the blame, was heaped by our politicians and the American ones on the French. But really, when you look back on that, you see that that was pretty feeble stuff. The full weight of our diplomacy was brought to bear on the elected members of the Council. It wasn't French lobbying, it wasn't actually the threat of a French veto, which caused these governments, like Mexico and Chile, to resist us. For good reasons or bad, they believed that what we were asking was unreasonable and unacceptable to their own peoples, yet we went ahead and started a war. Now, I'm not starry-eyed, ladies and gentlemen, and I wouldn't advise you to be starry-eyed about the United Nations as it at present works. I worked there for 4 years. I've sat hour after hour in the Security Council and in the General Assembly, and I really don't have many illusions. This is not a gathering of Democrats. In the Security Council, the veto reflects the power structures of 1945. And not of today. And in any case, the veto has been used originally by the Soviet Union, but now in the past quite often by the United States, for reasons which are far removed from their own essential interests. And there's a very strong case for enlarging the Council, for modifying the veto, and there are plenty of plans for both, but they are gathering dust. And neither form of reform is going to come about in the foreseeable future. Does it follow? And I ask you this. That because the Security Council is flawed and defective, which it certainly is, we should go back to the jungle and believe that we, because of our strong right arm and that of the superpower, are the only valid judges in authorizing killing. That is why the Secretary General, in his very cautious, he's a cautious man, but persuasive way, confronted member states with the problem of authority when he spoke to the UN General Assembly on September the 24th. He referred to the arguments for the preemptive strike. And he said, according to this argument, states are not obliged to wait until there is agreement in the Security Council. They reserve the right to act unilaterally or in ad hoc coalitions. This logic, he said, represents a fundamental challenge to the principles on which, however imperfectly, world peace and stability have rested for the last 58 years. My concern, he ended, is that if this were to be adopted, it would set precedents that resulted in the proliferation of the unilateral and lawless use of force with or without justification. But then, because he's a fair man, he added there's a problem. You can't just leave it at that and say nothing can be done. He went on to urge member states to discuss how, in these circumstances, the UN could best respond to the massive violations of human rights, possibly by considering its own preemptive action. In a recent address at Chatham House, the Archbishop of Canterbury suggested setting up a body of wise and respected people from across the world to weigh such cases, presumably in an advisory role to the Security Council, but they would possess a personal and collective authority which could strongly influence its deliberations. Or you could put more weight on the Secretary General himself, his office. He's a wise man and didn't actually suggest that. Perhaps remembering what happened when Margaret Hammershot, who was Secretary General when I was there, he through the years elevated his position using the not very clear wording of Article 99 of the Charter to produce almost the position of a high priest to be occupied by the Secretary General, by himself, and used precisely to advise the world on these kind of situations. But he ran into trouble, and in the end, his plane crashed in the Congo and he was killed. He was a great man, I'm diverting. He was a great man, but he ran a great risk, which in the end failed, in trying to create, precisely for this kind of reason, an authority for one person, the Secretary General of the UN, which actually would be unlikely to work and which Kofi Annan has not repeated. So I leave this point in the air, ladies and gentlemen, because that's where it is. The question of authority for such a preemptive strike remains unsettled. Yet it's clear now, quite apart from ethics, quite apart from legality, let's be entirely practical, it's clear now that the absence of such authority, action without such authority, adds substantially to the difficulties of those who take such action. And I turn now to the second day, to after authority, aftermath. Obviously, the case for humanitarian intervention doesn't rest simply on the arguments for removing an evil ruler. There must be a calculation that what follows, the regime which follows, is not only better, but matches to some extent the ideals of freedom and democracy, which we often proclaim, and which are there in the various international declarations on human rights, and indeed in the Charter itself. I.e., the toppling of statues is not enough, nor would be the killing or putting on trial of the dictator. What counts, in addition, is what follows. And the debate, really, in the early 90s on all this didn't really concentrate on this. It concentrated on how you get in, not on what followed or how you get out. And what followed in Bosnia, Kosovo, East Timor was a small-scale exercise in benevolent imperialism, which in Bosnia and Kosovo continues to this day with the presence of small numbers of foreign troops. In Afghanistan, the aftermath has been a skillful political exercise, which put in power a distinguished president, but has not yet achieved a central government capable of asserting authority over the outlying provinces or preventing what we see now, which is a limited, I hope limited, revival of the Taliban. In Iraq, what followed, after a brilliant military campaign, was a mess. A mess characterized in sequence by looting, lawless streets, and now a resistance movement which resorts to terrorism. Now, back to law for a moment. The Anglo-Americans are the occupying power, and that was acknowledged by the Security Council in its latest resolution. If you're the occupying power, you assume responsibilities for law and order. And the British and Americans have refused to, have kept that, have hugged that responsibility to themselves, refused to share it. But they're not carrying it out. They are not discharging it in Baghdad or in the central parts of Iraq. Why? Because the post-war plan was based on assumptions in the Pentagon, which quickly proved false. They ignored their own ignorance, and they trusted advisors, whom others knew and told them were untrustworthy. And the British government subordinated its thinking so completely to the United States that no serious efforts, questions, seemed to have been asked by us about this plan. And no attempt that I can detect was made to modify it in the light of rather long-standing British experience in Iraq or the Middle East. No attention was paid to those who predicted correctly that while most Iraqis would rejoice at Saddam Hussein's fall, I wrote before the war, you know, that they would dance around his coffin, it did not follow that they would welcome foreign military occupation. Ladies and gentlemen, it seems to me, this is very personal, that the recklessness of these assumptions in the Pentagon passes belief, and so does the failure of the British government to question them. To the extent that our newspapers still cover Iraq, and I now read the American newspapers when I want to know what's happening because our coverage is now puny, but to the extent that they do, or the Americans do, they think of it in terms of President Bush's growing political difficulty on the subject. But our own Prime Minister is equally involved in the same gamble and will pay a price if it fails. Now, of course, he was right last night to say, well, we've got to concentrate on the future. On the future, I think there's considerable agreement. It would be a disaster, not just for Britain and America and for Iran, but for the whole world if Iraq now descended into anarchy. The resistance movement in parts of the country gains recruits from the shootings, arrests, searches, checkpoints, which are the inevitable consequences of military occupation. When the Americans shoot 18 Iraqis in the streets of Fallujah and follow it up by killing 8 friendly Iraqi policemen by mistake, you don't have to wheel in al-Qaeda, ladies and gentlemen. You don't have to imagine busloads of shadowy Syrians. You don't have to produce the phantom of Saddam Hussein to explain why that town is hostile to American occupation. It is, for the reasons of what has happened there in recent weeks. And now, one can go too far on this. The resistance and its terrorist methods, which are indefensible, will never have the strength to dislodge the occupying armies. So Vietnam, though often mentioned now in the speeches of Democrat potential candidates in the American press, Vietnam is no comparison. It won't happen like that. But something else might happen. Unless the present pattern could be changed, the resistance can frustrate a peaceful political outcome. And there are other places where that is true. So the correct parallel, the thing we have to worry about, is not certain. I mean, we've got to work to prevent it. But the parallel we have to worry about, there are two. One is the West Bank in Gaza, where I was a month ago and saw what actually happens, what the effect of Israeli occupation is on people, and Chechnya, which I've not visited, but where I think it's very difficult to visit, but where I think something of the same is happening. And these comparisons, you don't need Vietnam, in my view, ladies and gentlemen. I think these comparisons are formidable and worrying enough. Now, the immediate withdrawal, as the Prime Minister said, as the President ceaselessly says, of British, American, and Polish troops is unthinkable. The efforts now being made to build up Iraqi security forces and to move towards an Iraqi constitution and the transfer of sovereignty to a decent Iraqi authority must be right and must be supported by everybody. But where I differ from the Prime Minister is when he says that because we are more or less agreed in this country anyway, and in the United States and in Europe, about the way forward, I don't agree with him that that should blind us or cause us to shut up about the lessons which need to be learned from the past. And this goes quite deep into how, not whether democracy is a good idea, but how you spread it. The notion that our invasion, our occupation, would create a model Western-style democracy, plus a free market economy on the lines which they began to operate, lines advocated by the Wall Street Journal, plus a foreign policy which quickly recognized Israel. These are the sort of Pentagon assumptions. They were always unreal and presumptuous, and I think they're more or less defunct. I entirely agree, and there will be Arabs present, and they will tell me if they disagree. I entirely agree that the Arab world suffers, is held back by the absence of free institutions and a civil society. It reminds me a little bit, this argument, of the one we had over Hong Kong when Chris Patten was governor and introducing peacefully, not with cruise missiles and bombs, more democratic institutions in Hong Kong. And I fully supported him. I thought this was our right to do that. I don't accept that other people in other parts of the world don't want or wouldn't benefit from democracy, because I'm sure that they would, and that is true of the Arab world as well as of China. And we can help from outside. But the Arabs have to plant institutions in their own soil, as is beginning to happen, as is happening in slowly along the Gulf, including even in Saudi Arabia, and will have to happen, in my view, in Egypt. Now, some of the lessons, so we have to learn lessons. It's what life's about. And some of the lessons we are learning may be beneficial. It's clear the United States has unrivaled military and economic power, but it needs partners if it's to follow its own constructive instincts. I say constructive because anyone who knows the United States knows that its underlying instincts and intentions and ambitions are constructive. But to be realized, the United States need partners. It's clear that the armed forces of the United States need to be trained for the previously despised tasks of nation building. I think it's also clear for Britain that our greatest single international asset is probably now the professionalism of our armed forces, even though our politicians may make from time to time improper use of it. I believe that the fundamental lesson lies in better understanding the necessary relationship between the United States and our allies. And Malcolm Rifkin will develop this, and he will take a slightly different view, I think, but he will be on the same sort of theme, I'm sure, in a week or so's time. In this respect, I believe Iraq is not a model to be followed, but an example to be avoided. We have a penny-farthing relationship with the United States, and I apologize if that metaphor is unfamiliar to some of you, but there used to be a bicycle 100-odd years ago with a huge wheel and a little wheel, and in this country it was called the penny-farthing because of the coins of that size. The penny-farthing relationship we now have with the United States is one in which the farthing is getting gradually smaller. And despite the Prime Minister's skills, which are great, his convictions, which are honourable, and his total loyalty to the United States, events in Iraq have shown the limits of loyalty's reward. That's to say, we now know from experience, new experience, that a British government cannot realistically expect to exercise the same kind of influence over United States policy which was enjoyed by Winston Churchill, or indeed, in my time, by Margaret Thatcher. Now, both those people knew, and if you read what they wrote, they knew very well they were dealing as a junior partner with the major partner. They understood that in planning D-Day, planning Operation Torch, and Margaret Thatcher's dealing with Reagan. They knew it wasn't an equal business, but they knew they were the junior partner, but they did manage, though they were often disappointed, they did manage to exercise a substantial influence over where the bicycle was going, and we didn't. And that's a big difference. And it has important consequences. There's only one remedy for this imbalance, and that lies in Europe. The Anglo-American alliance remains valuable, but by itself, in my view, it's no longer a proper basis for a vigorous and effective British foreign policy. Now, we Europeans should not wish to set ourselves up as rivals to the United States. This is where the French become unrealistic, in my view, and even from time to time, destructive. And we shouldn't pretend that that is our aim or that we could do it even if it was our aim. But a valid partnership between the United States and Europe is, in my view, the best way in which we can tackle the problems of authority and aftermath in any future humanitarian intervention. This requires a galvanizing of Europe, a galvanizing of what we Europeans do in diplomacy and defense, which is beyond the scope of this lecture, because it would take at least another hour to describe the defects of what we do now and the ways in which that could be corrected. But it is odd, and this is a point about British politics, that those in this country who are most strongly suspicious and of and opposed to European cooperation in defence, where Britain would be at least an equal partner for anybody else, those people seem prepared to accept the much greater subordination to the United States which we now see in Iraq. So to conclude, ladies and gentlemen, and to go back to the doctrine is of humanitarian intervention is not defunct. I think people will be more cautious after Afghanistan and Iraq in going into it without proper thought. But it's not defunct. It will never be defunct. The searchlight of the modern media is very erratic, and there are lots of horrible things happening in the world which the searchlight doesn't, particularly in Africa, which the searchlight doesn't happened upon, and Chechnya is actually an example. But where the searchlight of the media does light up a scene of man-made horror, then the intensity of this is such that inaction by all of us becomes indefensible, and that will happen again. And it's no good people who are realists mocking the idealism which then demands action, because that idealism is sincere and deeply rooted. But these two questions, which are in the air, unanswered satisfactorily, about authority, who judges, aftermath, what follows, these are not just theoretical concepts to be tossed about in debate. And I leave them in the air because that's where they are, and I don't have magic solutions. But I would say that the recent events show that the involvement of the UN with all its force is indispensable. Without some form of UN legitimacy, a major armed intervention is likely to run into trouble, which is why the British and Americans went back to the UN, having failed to achieve authority for the preemptive strike. They returned and obtained authority for the follow-up action. And also, without UN skills and resources, nation building is unlikely to thrive. That's where we are with an imperfect world organization, but which, inefficient, imperfect as it is, nevertheless, every now and then, proves itself indispensable. In my book, I describe what it was like as a young diplomat, age 26, in the British mission to the UN at the time of Suez. I'd only just arrived. I didn't know my way around. And I didn't know how to be helpful to the people I was meant to be working for, who were beside themselves with anxiety and upset at these unprecedented things that were happening, at the way London was not keeping them informed. They had to guess what was happening. They operated in a fog, and they saw the British position at the UN, which had been very carefully built up by very distinguished diplomats like Fabian Jebb and Bob Dixon. They saw it crumbling away in hours, and I felt completely helpless, having been there only a matter of days. But I remember from Britain then the scorn which in those weeks in the summer and autumn of 1956, the scorn which was heaped, including by some of my friends, on the UN, because we were preparing to use our own right arm to remove what we believed to be a desperate threat to our economy and our security, namely NASA's nationalization of the canal. We were wrong about the threat. We believed it passionately, and we were very scornful of the UN, which seemed to be pussyfooting around and impeding and preventing us from doing this. But when the time came, or after we made our effort, we were forced back to the UN for the remedy in the form of a UN force. Now, the parallel is far from exact. I fully understand that. But the same scorn for the UN was certainly there in the US and in some of our press, perhaps among some of our ministers, as we planned our preemptive strike on Iraq in our turn. Now, great powers, ladies and gentlemen, are not penitent by nature. I wouldn't ask even that President Bush next week should acknowledge the truth of anything that I've been saying. It's enough if he acts as if it was true. And that, I think, will actually, or is slowly actually beginning to happen. It will be enough if the United States and Britain, like Britain and France in 1956-7, are forced to accept for the future that there is an international community, that it is embodied, however imperfectly, in the United Nations, and that the support or opposition of the UN must weigh heavily in the scales of any military intervention which is not strictly and clearly in self-defense. Thank you for your patience in listening.
Well, Lord Hurd, thank you for a not unexpectedly thoughtful talk, which certainly, whilst measured in delivery, was not uncontentious, and in fact quite controversial in some respects. And I think we have the makings of a lively debate and discussion here, so, and I know Lord Hurd is very keen to take quite a few questions. I think that rather than bunch questions, as is quite fashionable these days, in groups of three, in order to deal with them more efficiently. I suspect that the sort of questions that may well be asked are not best gathered together in clumps, so I propose to take them individually and to try and look around the room as much as possible. The gentleman at the back caught my eye, right at the back. Yep.
Thank you very much for coming to LSE, first of all. My question is regarding the future of unilateral interventions. Do you think the superpower for you, but empire for me, will go and intervene in other parts of the world? Secondly, do you think it's in the interest of the superpower to have democracy in the Middle East from Iran to the Gulf nations?
I think that the United States, although, as I say, it will never admit this, or the administration won't admit this in so many words, will be now substantially more reticent. The idea that they're about to invade Iran, or that they're about to invade Syria, or attack North Korea, these kind of ideas, which were quite common in the spring, particularly after the brilliant military campaign in Iraq, they've rather evaporated, as things do. So I think there will be, is already more, more caution. Your question about democracy is, I think, more difficult. I believe in the long term, it is in all our interests that democracy should grow in the Middle East as elsewhere. I do believe that. I do believe that countries are stunted economically, socially, politically, if they don't have the kind of institutions which go with democracy. The trouble at the moment about the Middle East is that democracy is not likely to result in pro-Western governments or parliaments. Whether you're talking about Pakistan, or whether you're talking about Egypt, or above all, whether you're talking about Palestine. And the Palestinian question, to which has now been added the invasion of Iraq, have built up a sort of hostility to it, suspicion of the United States, which means that it's not just the rulers, it's not mainly the rulers, it's not President Mubarak and Crown Prince Abdullah, it's the people who go to the mosque, it's the people, it's the Palestinians, you know, who actually are most hostile to the United States. Now, getting over that hurdle, getting over that obstacle, is a huge difficulty. But, I mean, it's got to be attempted if you're serious about democracy. Otherwise, the United States, it's got to actually make the effort. How it makes the effort to solve the Palestine question, again, would take rather a long time, though we could settle it, I'm sure, in the course of this evening. But some effort of that kind is going to be needed if United States arguments and claims in respect of democracy in the Middle East are to make sense.
I'd like to just take a lady perhaps next, and then the gentleman at the front who signaled his interest. I just want to see if there's any right at the back. Lots of gentlemen. Okay. Perhaps the gentleman at the back, then the gentleman at the front, and then perhaps a question from upstairs. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Also, I thought it was a very interesting talk. I wanted to ask you something about your idea of authority or legitimate authority. You're sort of implicitly sympathizing with the Secretary General of the UN's views that the Security Council and more gradual approaches and more multilateralism was the way forward in terms of a less dangerous world order. We live in a world today where the United States is sufficiently powerful that it can invade a country in the Middle East despite the disagreement and opposition even of those countries that would normally be its allies. And what I wanted to ask is there any way that you can foresee a country which is as powerful as the United States is, i.e. powerful enough to do that, and which, as we know, the United States is, as Britain was in its own more powerful days, very temperamentally unsuited to giving up the idea of its sovereignty and its freedom to defend its interests. When its interests are at stake, as it thought they were in the case of Iraq, can you see a realistic way that the United States could be made to submit itself to the veto of other countries without either a fundamental change in its position of power in the world or a fundamental change to the underlying political attitudes of American foreign policy?
I think at present the remedy lies in the United States itself, you know, because there are institutions there which will provide a corrective, as they often have in the past. The fact that there are elections, the fact that there's a free press, the fact that there's a judiciary, you know, these are very precious things which operate against abuse of power. I mean, they do, and they will. But the trouble is that takes time, doesn't deal with the immediate crisis. No, to be honest, I don't see anything like the present US administration submitting itself. Indeed, if you go back to Woodrow Wilson and the way the Senate rejected the League of Nations, you see the same arguments at work. The United States was not willing, even then, it was not the superpower, to subject itself to any kind of international authority. So if there's no actual formal subordination of the superpower, then how do you actually persuade it? Because the one thing which distinguishes the United States from any previous superpowers, except to some extent parliamentary Britain in the 19th century, is that it is possible to be persuaded. It's not impervious. It's not impermeable. You can actually get through to it. And that's what, in fact, we're left with. And that's what the Prime Minister was trying to do, but for reasons I gave, with imperfect success.
Gentleman in front.
Thank you. Lord Hurd, I very much enjoyed the lecture, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. But I was slightly amused by your strictures about the justification for the use of force against Iraq. Because if my memory serves me right, the justification is exactly the same as the one which you used as Foreign Secretary in 1993 in what was admittedly an altogether more limited campaign after Iraq moved troops into the zone adjacent to Kuwait. What's changed? Why was the Security Council authority from 1990 good then and not now?
Well, it was, as you say, quite a different exercise. And I referred to something which I think you were involved in the intellectual discussion of, which was the attack on Kosovo without a Security Council resolution. I mean, I don't wish to be thought to be absolute on these things, which is why I brought in the Kosovo campaign, which I supported, even though it didn't have a Security Council resolution. And I supported, as you say, that very limited exercise, which also didn't. But this is slightly different. This was actually, you know, attacking the whole exercise, the whole part of a country, killing a lot of people, and turning the whole place upside down. I think there is a distinction of scale, though perhaps not of theory.
Question. Gentleman over there, running up the stairs. And then you are. Then.
Or a practical question with respect to the best way of implementing the politics of intervention. And I wonder whether you think it's through coalitions of the willing or through more permanent mechanisms such as NATO's reaction force. And if you do believe it is in more permanent mechanisms, should we invest in supporting such forces, such as the NATO force or maybe the European Rapid Reaction Force working together?
Yes, I think we should. Coalitions of the willing, this one was a bogus coalition of the willing. It was us and the Americans and the Australians and a handful from others. So I never use the word coalition. It seems to me unreal, let alone willing. It was not bad. And you know, the whole exercise has to be justified on grounds other than calling it something that it was not. So the more you institutionalize this, the better. The generals don't like too much institutionalization because, as General Wesley Clark complained about Kosovo, you know, it holds things up. And as we found in Bosnia, where we had the dual key, it operated in a wholly inefficient way. But I'm in favor of the NATO Reaction Force. I'm in favor of Europeans coming together and being able to do, as they have done in a tiny way already in the Congo and Macedonia, to operate by themselves. It would never be, in my view, against the wishes of the United States, but in circumstances where the United States itself does not wish to get involved on the ground. So I am in favor. Yes, I'm in favor of trying to institutionalize these choices insofar as that's possible. Are we having any from upstairs?
I've been looking upstairs. Oh, there's very few. Yes, I promised the gentleman there, and then right up at the top. Yes, it's your hand. We'll sort it out in a minute. So this gentleman, then we'll go upstairs.
Lord Hurd, why in 1991 did the powers that intervened in Kuwait conclude that somehow that containing Saddam was adequate?
Because the purpose of our effort, as I said, was to reverse the aggression. And that was a phrase used by President Bush very early on after his encounters with Margaret Thatcher on the mountain in Aspen in the hours after the invasion. And I don't think Margaret Thatcher made the policy, but I think she accelerated it. Anyway, quite quickly, he then said the aggression must be reversed, and that's what we did. And he got, with great difficulty, it's now forgotten this, the approval of the US Congress, and we got, in a way I got, the acceptance of the British Labour Party of that. We got the Europeans, we got most of the Arabs, we got a real coalition of the willing for the purpose of freeing Kuwait from aggression. It was not an exercise in changing regime or going on to Baghdad. And I happened to be in the White House on the day the war ended. There was no serious consideration, and in my view, as I argue in my book, could not be at that time any serious consideration of changing the rules, changing the basis on which this huge consensus had been achieved, and saying, oh, by the way, we've chased them out of Kuwait, and now we're going on to Baghdad. I mean, we would have had we would have had a breakdown here of national consensus, and I've heard President Bush Senior on this point, arguing the same in the United States. I've heard him say, with whose brother, with whose boyfriend, with whose husband was I supposed to go on to Baghdad and stay there and occupy it for X years? That was not the basis. That was not what I set out to do. It's not what I explained to the American people. It was not the mandate I had from them. And I believe that that is, I believe that is true. Of course, it's fair to add that we expected that, that defeat and the humiliation of that would enable the Iraqi people to get rid of him within a reasonably short time. That's perfectly true. We expected that, and that did not happen. But the actual process of changing the whole purpose of it was not, it's, you know, with benefit of hindsight, one can see how attractive it seemed. But it was not a practical option at the time. And a little pendant, I remember Margaret Thatcher, although she's entirely forgotten this now, in the very early days when she was still Prime Minister, I went to see her in her, and she was having a, what she called a holiday in Cornwall that was indistinguishable from her normal way of life. And she said to me, now you Foreign Office people are not very good always on the law. You know, I've had a law degree. I must tell you, you must bear it all in mind. We're not changing regime. We are reversing regression. We're not going beyond that. And, you know, she forgets that now. But that was the orthodoxy of the day, and as Prime Minister, she set that out for the guidance of her Foreign Secretary, in case I should be beguiled into rash adventures.
I think we take perhaps two questions from upstairs now. There are two questions more or less directly behind the pillar.
By line of sight, yep, hi, you, and then and lady behind you, I think.
What you called humanitarian intervention had brought in a specific modality in international relations, especially in the past decade. Under fights, Europe reconstructs and the UN keeps the peace. With Iraq, this is gone now. And what possible realistic scenario could bring this back, especially as far as the UN and the European Union involvement are concerned?
Well, I think that, I mean, you put it very neatly, I think that experience breeds caution. No, that's not quite true. Some experience breeds boldness out of frustration. But the wheel turns and something else happens and people start finding that they're cautious again. And I think that is happening now in the United States. As I said, without acknowledgement, because this is, you know, there's politics, there's an election campaign, people have to defend what they've said and done. Of course they do. But you can defend what you've said and done without intending to repeat it. And I think that the differentiation you talk about, United States armed strength, European money and diplomacy, UN legitimization, I mean, these are true differentiations. And I think in future, I hope in future, we'll see them operating rather more in tandem, rather more together than they did this year in Iraq.
There's a lady directly behind you, I think, right in the back, Fred? No?
My question is the role of oil. There was no oil. There is no oil in Rwanda. The instant the U.S. won in Iraq, their oil reserves went up sevenfold. I just wondered, whose humanistic case was the intervention for? So that is one question, and the second question is, I come from a country that opposed the U.S., not opposed it, but refused to participate in the Iraqi war, and we're now suffering because they're sniping at us all the time. In fact, I read today of a speech in which we were castigated again for some of our actions or failure to act, and this is what we will suffer in the future. And how far it'll go, I don't know, but we do our best to ignore them. So the question is oil and the failure of a country to follow the U.S.
Well, the oil point, of course, is familiar and appeals to those whose view of international relations is fundamentally cynical. I speak from my own experience. In the Gulf War I, in the first, oil, of course, I mean, everyone knew that Kuwait had oil, that Kuwait was important, but I just honestly say from my own experience and having looked up the papers lately and my own conversations with the two prime ministers and with the President of the United States, the fundamental point was one of reversing aggression. And I would say, if our main concern had been with the security of oil, of course we would have settled with Saddam Hussein. Of course we'd have said, you shouldn't have got it, you've got it, what's your price? What we would not have done if we'd been solely concerned with oil is launch a war which set the oil fields on fire and destabilized the whole system. So I think the argument about Gulf War I, that was based on oil, is actually, well, A, in my experience, historically wrong, and B, actually logically unreasonable. We're inconsistent. Rwanda is a classic case. And so is the Congo. I was vexed is a mild word, with President Clinton, who pursued what I think is historically and ethically unsound, which is the doctrine of apology. And actually, a time when people were dying in thousands in the Congo, and when he was doing nothing except the kind of diplomacy which he practiced in Bosnia, he apologized for doing nothing in Rwanda, but he wasn't doing anything in the Congo. You know, standards are double in the sense there will always be occasions where people find it too difficult to act. And Europeans acting in Africa is a very likely example, except in small cases, like the British in Sierra Leone and the French in the Côte d'Ivoire. You know, it is not likely that you will see European or American governments committing large numbers of troops to Africa. It would just not seem sensible, whatever is going on there, which is why it's so important to build up African ability and willingness to deal with situations. Your second point, I have great sympathy. I'm not quite sure of your nationality, and there's no reason why you should disclose it. But I mean, the doctrine that it's perfectly okay for the US to lobby the world for its draft Security Council resolutions, but improper and disloyal for anybody to lobby for an other view, seems to me completely wrong. That is an exercise of privilege by a superpower which will not actually work, and emphatically did not work on this occasion. Of course, the aftermath is a lot of bad blood, and insults fly around, and politicians like insults, like giving them, because that produces headlines in the paper, just exactly as you've described. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to live through this. I mean, we have to be adults, and we have to try to live as far as possible in an adult world, where hard words don't actually break any bones.
Some more. There's a gentleman over there, and the gentleman there, in that order.
Sorry, Lord, just a short one, not to throw petrol into the flames, on oil, and that is that I think that oil must play a considerable pragmatic importance in that if we are to build a modern Iraq, the Iraqi people are going to need that oil to be sold at a sufficient price in order to fund the modernization of Iraq. And the second factor is we in the West need that oil as there is a demand for it. So oil does play a practical consideration in these matters. There's no, even though sometimes it's cynically portrayed.
No, I entirely agree with both your points are obviously true. I'm not denying the both those are important practical factors now, I agree.
I promised there was a gentleman, I think, over here. No, sorry. I can't remember who it was. The lady, yes, in that case, please. And then Chris Hill.
It would be very interesting to get your opinion on a quite sensitive issue. On a quite sensitive issue. How should one consider the intention to physically destroy Saddam Hussein, which the US intended to carry out, otherwise than an act contrary to international law? Wouldn't it be just murder without trial?
To kill him without trial?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, this is the question. I mean, is that in your opinion, contrary to international law or in accordance with international law? How would we judge it? Thank you.
Well, I can't think that it's, now that there's no actual war, I can't think that it's in accordance with international law, but I don't think it would be very unkindly judged by most people if it actually happened, say, tonight in North Iraq. So I don't think actually, in practice, it is a question of law. In a way, it would be felt widely that he's put himself outside the law.
Now, I had promised the gentleman over here before Chris Hill. Gentleman here, then Chris Hill, and I'll take another one.
Thank you very much. One of the central principles underlying the conduct of international relations seems to be the preservation of the existing system of boundaries and states. Do you believe that these are set in stone for the rest of the 21st century, or do you believe it's going to be possible to accept some revision?
Well, I mean, it's always possible to accept revision of boundaries by agreement. I mean, the classic example now is the West Bank and Gaza and Palestine, where there are no accepted boundaries, and yet clearly if there's going to be peace, there have to be boundaries. So, I mean, and there may be other places across the world, although I'm not at the moment thinking of any, but then there certainly will be some, where the boundaries are contested. I think the business of changing boundaries by force will never be accepted. Of course, many of the boundaries in the world are artificial. The colonial boundaries in Africa were made by Bismarck and Lord Salisbury, and whoever was the Portuguese foreign minister, you know, in a map in the Foreign Office. And they're straight lines because it was easier to draw straight lines, and etc. But on the other hand, the OAU, the Organization of African Unity, one of its first decisions was to say no one's to muck around with these borders because they're what we got. And that was probably quite a wise decision. So on the whole, I think there will be alterations, and there will be no Middle East settlement without the creation of boundaries. But altering them by force, I think, is unlikely to be sustained. You're coming to me, Andrew.
Yes, we are. Chris Hill.
Lord Hurd, two related points. As you say, so often the cry goes up, someone must do something. But another question that arises in this context is, why is it so often Britain that must do something or be in the lead of doing something? I wonder whether I detect in your remarks, and perhaps indeed in your time as Foreign Secretary, the view that perhaps we would be better served by a slightly more quietist foreign policy than we have pursued over the last 50 years.
Well, I've often thought about that, and I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to that. I think there is. It was very interesting going to Bosnia, and maddening, because we and the French were the ones whose analysis was on the whole most quietest, shall we say, but who were actually in a position to put in troops. The two countries which felt most strongly felt unable themselves to do anything about it, namely the Americans and the Germans. And this produced night after night, yeah, meeting after meeting, feelings of barely suppressed irritation on both sides. And we mustn't get back into that position. No, we are in it because we punch above our weight, to use a phrase which I'm accused of inventing, because we punch above our weight, we do tend to be in the front line of these things. We have a very activist prime minister, a sort of Gladstonian prime minister at the present time, whose heart is in this kind of thing. And my own, I mean, I specifically said, you'll never do away, and you shouldn't do away with the doctrine of humanitarian intervention. But my own instincts are on the more cautious side for the kinds of reason, questions of authority and aftermath which have not been solved in this particular case.
Okay, I think we need to start wrapping up. If I might just ask you, if you just hang back for 1 minute, Lord Hurd is just going to take up position, so to speak, just outside in the lobby area, for those who might be interested in perusing or even buying his book. But I think it remains for us to thank him and to give a very heartfelt applause for a very good book.